Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear it. Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is Sunday, November 1st, 2009. Bill Fink is joining us for an installment of Germany and the Jewish Problem by Dr. F.K. Wiebe, and this shall be probably the first of several, if not many.
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Hello, praise Yahweh.
I'd like to start with a quote from a source which might surprise some people. No man will treat with indifference the principle of race. It is the key of history. And why history is so often confused that it has been written by men who were ignorant of this principle and all the knowledge it involves. Language and religion do not make a race. There is only one thing that makes a race, and that is blood. Mm-hmm. And that was quoted by Wiebe in the first part to his first chapter. And that's from Benjamin Disraeli. A Jew said those words.
I was about to say it's a familiar quote, and it's coming from a Jew.
If I said that in front of 900 million Americans, well, there aren't that many. There might be with all the Mexicans. That they'd all say Adolf Hitler said that,
yeah.
And it's a Jew, Benjamin Disraeli. And if a Jew felt this way, then in order for Christians to maintain the character of their civilization, they too have to feel this way, and without apology, because this is what we're up against, and we don't even know it. That this is, you know, the Jews are fiercely, we know they're a mixed race, and they know they're a mixed race, but you're either on their side or you're not. You're either an Aryan or you're a mutt like them. And if you're a mutt like them, well, they like that, and they seek to control all the mutts like them, but they'll, you're a lot more valuable to them than an Aryan. That's just the way it is. That's the pattern that they've set in history. And if you stand up for your Aryanism, well, that's evil. If you stand up for being a German, that's evil. But any other race can stand up for themselves, and that's okay. And
well,
when are Americans going to wake up to that? It's just crazy that people don't understand that.
If they permitted Germans to openly stand up for their people, that might derail their efforts to dominate and direct the future of the German nation and the German people.
Right. The whole thing to me just shows how good the media is, and how good the media can distract and poison one's mind. And most people get everything that they know from the mainstream media, and it's controlled by the Jew.
So in essence, they get nothing. In fact, they get worse than nothing. It would be far better if they were living in a cave and had no access to information, because they would still have common sense and natural inclination and instinct, but now they've been polluted and contaminated by lies.
Maybe. And I'd like to say, we're about to, you know, the things we're about to read are from Dr. Carl Wiebe, this Germany and the Jewish Problem, and they're not from Adolf Hitler, but most of them agree with things that Adolf Hitler said. And a lot of nationalist men in Germany during the Weimar years felt the same way. But Adolf Hitler was not the first to realize, he was not the first German to realize it was a Jewish problem. On pages 77 and 78 of Mein Kampf, he discussed the failed anti-Jewish movements within the political parties at the end of the 19th century. And there was a Christian Socialist Party, and there was a Pan-German Party, which is really a nationalist party. And they had anti-Jewish platforms or sects, and they went down in flames. And Hitler explains why, and I'm not going to cover that. The important thing is that there were people Christian men who stood against Judaism for a long time before Adolf Hitler did.
Well, I'd like to just briefly mention the Pan-German movement and tie their failures to the coming failure and collapse of the British National Party, in so much that the Pan-German movement was exclusive in regards to denying Jews entering their party, but politically they basically made the exact same moves the BNP is making now, but the BNP is going so far as to accept Jews openly in their ranks. They're now accepting all non-whites, and they have several prominent Jewish members in high-ranking positions. So not only is the BNP repeating all the mistakes of the Pan-German movement, they're now making newer, more deadlier mistakes, in so much that they're accepting Jews, and that is essentially going to prove fatal. The BNP, in my opinion, is terminally ill.
When Jews join a movement like that, when Jews join conservative parties, when Jews join nationalist parties, they do it for one reason: to marginalize and basically make those parties vacuous. That they do it to neutralize those parties. That's why they join them.
And if we look, the BNP is watering down everything they claim to believe in so much to make it palatable to the masses. But as Hitler pointed out, we should not be interested in making a message palatable to the masses. We should be interested in finding those people who are inclined to become revolutionaries or already are revolutionaries and get them organized and mobilized and get them behind a central program, a platform, and make them understand why you need to do this and why you need to go in this direction. We shouldn't be talking to people that are just idiots and listen to whatever they read in the newspaper or hear on the radio. I'm not really interested in swaying the masses, because the masses really have nothing to do in directing the course of human events.
No, it's a small minority of people that direct the course of human events. A popular example of that's the American Revolution, which
absolutely
may have been participated in by 5 to 10% of the Americans.
So I think anybody that expects any good to come from the BNP, they should probably just read pages maybe 60 to 75 in Mein Kampf, read the part about the Pan-German movement in particular, and everything that was wrong with the Pan-German movement can be applied to the BNP today, except the BNP's taken it so much further, they've basically sold out and gone political, and they're now all just careerists and opportunists and weaklings who want to keep their jobs.
Well, absolutely. They're going to be marginalized under Nick Griffin, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I'd say within 5, 10, if not sooner, in terms of years, the BNP will just be a memory. No one will really pay them any attention, and they'll be lucky if they can get on the BBC. They'll have to resort to petty publicity stunts, or they'll just marginalize themselves even further by accepting some gay black mulatto Jew and having them as a spokesperson. Ooh, the racist BNP.
The only legitimate form of nationalism is an ethnic nationalism.
Absolutely.
And without the word ethnic associated with its nationalism, that they may as well be Tories. They may as well just go join the Tories.
Well, other than that, there would just be an imperialistic or a dynastic nationalism of the sort that historically has proven unsound and that Hitler absolutely detests. And he builds, as far as I'm concerned, an airtight, rock-solid case against dynastic nationalism by showing how destructive that was in regards to people who gave their loyalties to the undeserving Habsburg monarchy, the monarchy that was out to destroy the very nation that they relied upon for power.
Well, the Habsburgs became an empire, and that was their mistake. And imperialism it leads right to empire, and empires all can't stay together. A government with competing interest groups, the groups are always going to work against each other.
Well,
look at America today.
Yeshua said, no man can have two masters. I would say so too. No state can serve two people. Either it's going to favor one group and disfavor the other, or there'll be some combination. And I've often said that in America, the government has simply artificially created a group known as colored people, despite the fact that Mexicans really have nothing in common with blacks. They hate each other, the same with Arabs. But they've simply made a group of coloreds. They favor them, and the people who are disfavored are our people, whites. So it's basically everybody versus us.
All the time. I'd like to move on with Wiebe.
Certainly.
And page 6. It is a mistake to believe that the Jewish question has only arisen within the last few years, or indeed that its origin is to be sought in modern times. The Jewish question is not an invention of National Socialism, nor is it derived from the anti-Semitic movements, meaning pan, that's a reference back to Pan-Germanism, that marked the close of the 19th century.
And
if National Socialism can lay claim to any originality in matter, then it's only because the National Socialist Party was the first to deduce the logical conclusions from a historical fact. The present German attitude towards the Jewish question is based on the experience made by Europe in the course of 2,000 years. And this experience has been a particularly bad one for Germany, especially during the last few decades, which is a reference to Weimar and World War One.
It's interesting you should start with this quote, since I have this one highlighted and asterisked, and I have two quotes from well-known religious figures, and can I bring those into play here, if that's
sure.
All right? One is from Martin Luther. If I were to baptize a Jew, I would conduct him to a bridge on the Elbe, tie a stone around his neck, and throw him over the side. So that's Martin Luther on discussing the proper way to baptize a Jew. My next quote is from Pope Clement VIII. All the world suffers from the usury of the Jews, their monopolies and deceit. They have brought many unfortunate people into a state of poverty, especially the farmers, working class people, and the very poor. Then, as now, Jews have to be reminded intermittently anew that they were enjoying rights in any country since they left Palestine and the Arabian Desert, and subsequently their ethical and moral doctrines, as well as their deeds, rightly deserve to be exposed to criticism in whatever country they happen to live. And he said that in the 16th century.
Right. Well, you know, I think it was about the 7th century that Thomas Aquinas said that the Jew should not be allowed to keep the money that he gained from usury. That there's, you know, the Jew is an alien being who invades communities and loans money at usury. And not only does he loan the money at usury, and we're going to see before this segment is over, I mean, maybe not tonight, but next week, that the Jew causes the need for money to be loaned at usury. The Jew is the whoremaster. The Jew is the owner of the gambling house that caused the nobles, and I mean the weakness of men, it's comes into serious play here, but the Jew is the panderer and the moneylender at the same time. He's taking your money through gambling proceeds, and he's going behind your back and loaning it to you with his other hand.
Well, not to mention that he also instigates conflict and war through his connections at various European courts, and then as the nation is either suffering defeats and is on the ropes and they're in dire need of money, or they just need that little bit, you know, more gold to complete the victory that is nearly secured, they turn to the money lenders.
Right, and we'll get into that too. And in fact, even, you know, many noblemen had borrowed money from the Jews to send troops off to the Crusades for the popes, to raise armies for the Crusades.
How ironic.
Oh, that's absolutely ironic. And that actually happened from the time of the First Crusade right away. So we'll get into the Jews and the noble classes, and Hitler talks about them at length, and Wiebe talks about them also. How the noble classes were always in bed with the Jews, and Hitler actually equated that to sleeping with Satan. And that the Charlemagne admitted the Jews into the Holy Roman Empire in the 9th century because he felt they were useful for commercial purposes. Because Christians didn't loan money at interest. And it was commercialism right away that got us into trouble.
It wasn't a matter of seeking industrious, hardworking people for agriculture and or industry. He just wanted a bunch of moneylenders around.
Exactly. They needed moneylenders. They wanted moneylenders.
One thing I would like to address is the point, what is your take on the typical Jewish answer that they've been forced into money lending because other trades were closed to them? Do you see any historical evidence that other trades were closed to them?
There is some historical evidence, but it's taken out of context. Mm. It's absolutely taken out of context that long before other trades were closed to the Jews, they chose to be moneylenders.
Absolutely.
They chose to be panderers. There's no doubt. And there were Jews with honest trades, and it's depicted in Byzantium and in some of the cities of Italy, that they when they were forced to work honest trades, when they couldn't make money doing anything else, they worked an honest trade.
Well, one
in
thing,
fact, they were big in the leather industry in medieval Byzantium.
When they mention Nostradamus being an apothecary, yet at the same time they say that Jews were prohibited from practicing any sort of medicine, that doesn't go together, does it?
That's a lie, because Jews were the court doctors to Saxon kings, to the kings of the Byzantine Empire, to the emperors. They were the court doctors to the nobility in Europe for thousands of years. They were never forbidden from practicing medicine, and not generally anyway.
All right.
There may have been specific. I'm not saying that there weren't specific laws in various places. I would say that I don't know, but for the most part, Jews were the court doctors to the emperors and the nobility for thousands of years, for centuries. So
they were pretty much free to pursue whatever trades they wanted, and they simply decided that money lending suited their character the best.
Absolutely, money lending, being doctors, being panderers, and retail trades. They engage in retail trade because they can't. That they don't do labor.
Mm-hmm. No.
Very few Jews will do actual physical labor. I mean, it does happen, but it's not very common.
Now, when I came across I was doing some research, specifically looking up a few quotes for this program. I came across one site run by Jews. They maintain that one of the popes prohibited Jews from selling new goods, and they were only allowed to sell secondhand merchandise, and this gave rise to the vicious stereotype that Jews sell worthless trash. Now, I highly doubt, why would the Pope say that the Jews can sell secondhand goods but not new goods? They gave no logic.
I don't think there's any substantiation for that. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think there's any substantiation for that.
They didn't offer
anything. It was well known that Jews were the merchants and ran the sailing vessels across the Mediterranean between Byzantium and Italy and Spain for many centuries.
All right. Well, continuing along with F.K. Wiebe, would you like to press on, or shall I read the next paragraph that I have highlighted?
Be my guest. I'll backtrack if I feel you missed something.
Okay, certainly. It is unique and in the last resort inexplicable phenomenon that on the one hand the Jews have never been able to find a permanent home in which to develop a political and social existence sui generis, while on the other hand they have never proved capable of being absorbed by any of the innumerable countries in which they have sought hospitality. Do you think this is just, he doesn't recognize it for what it is, but this is the curse of Cain, their wandering. He recognizes the wandering, but he doesn't recognize why.
Absolutely. You know, Hitler knew that the Jews had a satanic nature, but he called them the so-called chosen people, quite like he didn't quite believe they were the Israelites of the Old Testament, but sometimes he refers to them as Israel. And he knew they were satanic, but I don't think he fully understood why. And Wiebe does not know it all, and he just takes it for granted that the Jews are the Israelites of the Old Testament.
So he can recognize their conduct, and he can observe just through his life experiences and his study of the Jews that they're demonstrably, disgustingly wicked people, but he doesn't have the scriptural understanding to piece it all together.
Right, and he says that they never had their own political and social existence sui generis. Sui generis really means like of an original kind, okay? In other words, they never created their own political and social kingdom or governmental unit, national unit.
Well, I would disagree. I would say Bolshevism.
Well, right. Bolshevism is one, but Bolshevism was built on the ashes of something that they destroyed.
Yes.
And they left all of the mechanical parts of it in place, the factories, the coal fields, the oil wells. They left all that in place. so that they could take advantage of it and loot and pillage the wealth of the nation.
But in terms of a
student of the Old Testament should know that the children of Israel did have a basically original political and social existence during the kingdom period. But it seems that Wiebe is ignorant of a lot of that. He's very good with the later history of his own nation, and he's very good with the behavior of the Jews and their interactions in surrounding nations through the medieval period, but he's not a Bible student.
All right. Would you like to discuss anything from page 7, or shall we move along to page 8? Do you think it's worthwhile to discuss the expulsion of the Jews from country after country after country?
It's worthwhile to quote this Jewish lexicon, which Wiebe quotes, where it says that this Jewish problem, and this is from a Jewish source, and he cites it, this Jewish problem is as old as the association of the pronouncedly differentiated and dissimilar Jewish people with other peoples. I would just attribute that to the fact that they're the Edomites and Canaanites of the Old Testament, in contrast to all of the Aryan nations in the vicinity.
Well, there's one more quote I think that we can tie in from an outside source. We Jews, we are the destroyers and will remain the destroyers. Nothing you can do will meet our demands and needs. We will forever destroy because we want a world of our own. And that's by Maurice Samuels, page 155 of the book You Gentiles.
Right.
Now, with that mentality in mind, is it very difficult to see why most people that are around Jews for any length of time wind up hating Jews?
Well, you know, this Satan is a hateful character. I mean, it's not in our nature to get along with them. And if we realize that, And we don't, I'm not saying we have to go kill all the Jews, but if we separate ourselves from their communion, they'll go away. The problem will disappear. But Christians
Absolutely.
Can't be tricked by the Antichrist.
And we're told, who is an Antichrist but he who denies that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God?
Well, absolutely.
And
they are the Antichrist.
As an entire people, every single Jew denies that every single day.
The only reason why we fall under their power and under their spell and we accept their definitions of good and evil, because it's the Jew that gets us to abort our children. They're behind that. They're behind the homosexual movement. Well, we're going to find out that they're behind all of the so-called revolutionary movements of the mid-1900s. And if we never listened to them or never gave them any credibility in public, then we would never have these problems in our nation.
Absolutely. Well, we're told that everything shall be made known. So ultimately, our people will know the truth, won't they?
Right. He goes back as far as the Assyrian deportations of Israel and doesn't realize that is not the Jews. And the proper history of the dispersion of the Jews starts in 70 AD.
Yes, he mentions that, but he falsely attributes the Babylonian and Assyrian dispersions to Jewry.
Right, and even the Bible makes a clear distinction that the Babylonian and Assyrian dispersions are of the true children of Israel. The enemies of God are the people that are dispersed in 70 AD. They're absolutely different people.
I think it's in John chapter 8 when they're confronting Yeshua. They say that they have never been in bondage to any man. Now, how would that be possible if they were the people in Assyria and in Babylon?
Well, right, and even in Egypt. It's clear from the intertestamental period history that the Jewish people are the Edomites and Canaanites of the Old Testament. They're not Judah. They're not Israel. They're Esau and they're Canaan. But Hitler and Wiebe didn't understand that, just like most people today still don't understand that. The most educated men have always taken it for granted that the Jews were those people. It's like if all the white people are mixed in this country and 600 years from now the Negro blood prevails or some I mean some monster that's mixed out of Negro and Mexican blood and Oriental blood prevails. It, who knows what we'd look like or what our successors will look like. But it's like believing that they were the first Americans.
Yes. Someday they'll teach that George Washington looked like Obama.
Exactly. And someday they'll be painting pictures of the founding fathers and they all have afros. if we keep on the pace that we're on now.
Well, before we leave the places that the Jews have been expelled from, could I just rattle off a list of maybe 5 or 10 countries and provinces and name some dates?
Fine, because you could probably go further than Wiebe did.
Well, starting here, Carthage, 250, Alexandria, 415, Clement, the Diocese of Clement, France, 554, Visigoth, Spain, 612, the entire Visigoth Empire, 642, all of Italy, 855, France, 1182, Germany, 1182, Upper Bavaria, 1276, England, 1290, France, 1306, France again, 1322, Switzerland, 1348, Saxony, 1349, Hungary, 1349, Hungary, again, 1360. Now, some of these countries, it becomes a matter of again, 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 and I could list them 6, 7 times in a 20-year
period. Which shows how they
always
sneak their way back in. They always buy their way or sneak their way or weasel their way back in.
Perfect example, Naples, 1496, Naples again, 1533, Naples again, 1541, and then the Papal States, 1569. I see Bavaria is on this list about 8 or 9 times. Vienna, 1669. Vienna, 1670.
Well, the first crusade, for the most part, took place in Frankfurt, in the Rhineland,
mm-hmm.
against the Jews. I don't know if they ever got past there. I'm really not a student of medieval history, so I don't know the details. But I know that the first crusade basically was a pogrom against the Jews in Frankfurt, in the Rhineland.
Yes.
And that took place in the 11th century, 1090 something, I think.
Yes, I think it was 1096. They decided that if they were going to do something for the glory of God, they might as well start by killing the Jews.
Well, what we have is we have a long history, and Hitler did not invent anti-Semitism. And Hitler is not the supreme devil as the Jews say he is. This struggle has been clearly going on for 2,000 years. I mean, it's the enmity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. We know that, but most Americans would never understand that because they don't know any of this history. It's hidden from them. The Jewish media hides it from us. You have to go look for it. It's not taught in schools. I never learned this in schools. I was an ace at history for the couple of years I went to school, but I never learned any of this. And I've spoken to many people who, with college degrees, that never knew any of this. They didn't specialize in history, but it seems that a very small percentage of the population is even comes across this.
Well, if we were taught that hatred of the Jews has a multiple thousand-year precedent of history behind it, and that they've been kicked out of everywhere they've ever been, we might start to ask questions about what they could do that would bring this down upon them.
Well, that's the bottom line, is what behavior do they participate in that they just get everybody mad no matter where they go?
Well,
which is what it boils down to.
Yes, and the when we get into the Frankfurt School, they basically had to develop a theory of anti-Semitism that removed Jewish conduct from the theory.
And that was the gist of the Frankfurt School, but that also became the pop psychology of the 60s. That brought us all the psychoanalysis of the 1960s and all of the other psychiatric sciences or psychological sciences based a lot of their dogmas on the writings of the people, the Jews at the Frankfurt School.
Yes, that we're all envious of the Jews. We're all projecting our latent desires onto them because they get to live the lives we just wish we could live. I mean, honestly, do you envy anything about a pimp or a dope peddler?
And that entire movement was created to protect the crimes of the Jews, basically, and to nip anti-Semitism in the bud, and to destroy the American family and the American, the patriarchal, the Saxon patriarchal model in this country. I'd like to get on with Wiebe.
All right, certainly.
The opinion of the so-called modern era seems nevertheless to herald a period of permanent peace and rest for the hitherto restless wandering Jew. It was the era of enlightenment. And that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the enlightenment. And I often have said that Satan was let out of the pit with the enlightenment. And if you read Kevin MacDonald, The Culture of Critique, he basically says that it's with the enlightenment that the Jew starts dominating the intellectual movements of Europe.
Yeah.
Now, Wiebe says it was the era of enlightenment, of liberalism, of belief in the ideals of progress and the rights of man. These are all Jewish ideals, by the way. Conformably with the principles in vogue in this era, the Jews only differed by their religion from other citizens and as such enjoyed equality with the adherents of other religious bodies, in other words, ecumenicalism. They were no longer considered as appertaining to a different race, in other words, as strangers. Differentiation on ethnical grounds between Jews and the native population was, on principle, abolished by the French Revolution, and this principle was adhered to alike by the legislation and the social custom of ensuing decades. And I would say that the French Revolution was Jew-created. It
Absolutely.
Was created by the Jews of the Grand Orient Lodge.
I'd like to read a few quotes here, one from Bernard Lazar. Jew is not satisfied with de-Christianizing. He Judaizes. He destroys Catholic or Protestant faith. He provokes indifference, but he imposes his idea of the world, of morals, and of life upon those whose faiths he ruins. He works at his age-old task, the annihilation of the religion of Christ. And then another quote, The Jewish World, March 15, 1923, quote, Fundamentally, Judaism is anti-Christian, end quote. Then again, The Jewish World, February 9, 1883. The great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teachings and that in a universal brotherhood of nations, a greater Judaism, in fact, all the separate races and religions shall disappear.
Now, Robespierre, after they prevailed in the French Revolution, Robespierre anointed himself the high priest of his new official state religion.
And I think Robespierre had to be a Jew.
Well, I believe so. I don't have evidence, but I've always believed that he probably was. And there were many Jews in the Grand Orient Lodge in France, and they were basically responsible for fomenting the entire revolution, wiping out a lot of the race of the nobility of the French people. I want to say the more noble race of the French people in lieu of a better term. And
yes.
not necessarily only the nobility itself.
But we would say that those that were noble in blood and character.
Right. And they left the riffraff and their fellow Jews and all of the Moors and the half Arabs and they really destroyed the blood of France. And what the Jews didn't get in the French Revolution, Napoleon got by having them defeated by the Saxons and the English in his armies.
Napoleon advanced the cause of the Jews in France?
Well, you know, Napoleon was making his own money. He was against the money power. So there's more to the Napoleon story is more complex than we could be led to believe. He actually worked against the Rothschilds, and that's why the Rothschilds got together with the Prussians, and you know, they got the English and the Prussian armies together and destroyed them.
In fact, it was basically the First World War, wasn't it? Basically every province, country, duchy, county, whatever you want to say, in Europe was involved in the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes, absolutely. And he gained allies in in Bavaria and certain other German provinces by promising them Prussian territory, and there was a lot of underhanded deals, and it was basically an all-European war.
And it gave the Jews a great lift, because in the midst of the war and towards the conclusion, the Rothschilds wind up basically sitting at the juncture of all money markets in Europe, didn't they?
Yes, they did. The Rothschilds were the victors of the Napoleonic Wars, just like they were the victors of the First and Second World Wars. There's no doubt. No doubt in my mind, anyway.
Some people, I'd say most people in our country today, they consider Jews to just be whites who adhere to a different religion, don't they?
Right. That's basically what Wiebe just said in the quote I read, was that the French Revolution was the beginning point where the distinction of the Jews as a race was abolished.
Well, it seems that I find a quote in Mein Kampf that Hitler was under this mistaken thought for a while, but he got out from it. Can I go ahead and make the quote so people can understand what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Page 41, once when passing through the inner city, he's referring to Vienna, I suddenly encountered a phenomenon in a long caftan and wearing black side locks. My first thought was, is this a Jew? They certainly did not have this appearance in Linz. I watched the man stealthily and cautiously, but the longer I gazed at the strange countenance and examined it feature by feature, the more the question shaped itself in my brain, is this a German?
Right, that's from page 42 of Mein Kampf, right?
41.
That's Hitler. That was the Jews that he saw in his small village. He only saw a few, but apparently they must have had a lot of white blood in them. Because he thought they were just people of a different religion. That's right. But when he went to the big city and he saw these these Orthodox Jews in their fancy get-ups and their funny hairdos and their strange countenances, that made him wonder. Right, that was his awakening. That was when he realized that they were a different race.
The wonder that more Americans haven't found themselves in this situation. Or maybe they have, they just don't talk about it.
Well, you know, Middle America, right. The Jews they see are Hollywood Jews, and they're pretty polished compared to the Jews in Brooklyn. Yeah, you know, I'm used to seeing the Jews in Brooklyn, the Jews in the Diamond District, and they're a totally different creature. They're the typical rabbi-looking Jew. I actually put a post up on the forum at Christigenia tonight, and I had collected some pictures of Jews, and I'm going to put more up there, and I called it the Faces of Canaan, and it's in the miscellaneous banter section of my forum, and it actually. I mean, they're the Jews I'm accustomed to seeing in New York. But when you look at Goldie Hawn, well, she's a Jew, and you wouldn't know it, and you might actually fall into that trap if you tripped over her. I mean, she's really not bad looking, but she's a Jew. She's part Jewish.
More people, they're just used to seeing the polished Hollywood Jews that have nose jobs and cosmetic surgery instead of, say, the Alan Greenspan Jew.
Right. And it's a long-standing joke in New York that the average Jewess for her 16th birthday gets a nose job. If her father's worth his weight in Jew, if her father has the money.
All right, so where do you want to go next in Wiebe?
All right, the 19th century was dominated by the tenet of the emancipation and assimilation of the Jews. It was considered best not even to mention the Jewish question and to act as if such a question did not even exist. In the countries of Western Europe, the Jews themselves were animated by an intense desire for assimilation. Now, this is Wiebe's assessment. I would say that was probably just a pretense. Conversions and mixed marriages were the principal means employed by the Jews for acquiring, in the words of Heinrich Heine, himself a Jew, an admission ticket to European culture, and thereby acquiring a preponderating influence in political, cultural, and economic life. It should be added that a number of Jews were inspired by a sincere desire to throw off their skin and obliterate as far as possible their hereditary tracts.
Well, I immediately have two scriptural quotes to deal with this issue. Shall
yeah,
I go
well,
ahead and
they can't
it?
Change their skin. Go on.
I'm going to say Jeremiah 13:23. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? Then may ye also do good that are accustomed to do evil. Therefore will I scatter them as the stubble that passeth away by the wind of the wilderness. Then going to Obadiah. In the house of Jacob shall be a fire, in the house of Joseph a flame, in the house of Esau for stubble. Here's that word again, stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it. So here we go again, that they're going to be scattered as stubble. Those that are accustomed to doing evil, who then feign to do good, they're going to be stubble.
Right, and we're told that we can't, in the time of the end, you wouldn't be able to tell the wheat from the tares. And this is how. I mean, if there was no race mixing with the Jews, we'd always be able to tell the wheat from the tares. But a lot of our people are weak and give in to them and make marriages of convenience or marry for money. And this is the result. The society that we have today is the result of that.
And I'm looking at these, if you want to call them peer Jews, there's really no such thing, but these Jews on your form, and I'm about ready to vomit.
Oh, by looking at the pictures on the forum?
It's just hideous.
They're a hideous people. They're Satan. I mean, Satan is he's the opposite of the image of God. I mean,
in fact, I'm going to post a link in the chat. The 1 second from the bottom, that's just, vulgar. I think the Jew is the physical embodiment of evil.
Absolutely. If they were really God's people, they wouldn't look like that.
But they say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But then again, that's what ugly people usually say as a cop-out, isn't it?
Absolutely. But there's no and our people have sold themselves out to that in very many ways. And it's the whole country today. That we're totally sold out to them. I'd like to quote from Mein Kampf, pages 176 and 177. It was due to the German princes that the German nation could not succeed in definitely freeing itself from the Jewish peril. Unfortunately, the situation did not change at a later period. The princes finally received the reward which they had a thousandfold deserved for all of the crimes committed by them against their own people. They had allied themselves with Satan, and later on they discovered that they were in Satan's embrace. By permitting themselves to be entangled in the toils of the Jew, the princes prepared their own downfall. The position which they held among their people was slowly but steadily undermined, not only by their continued failure to guard the interest of their subjects, but by the positive exploitation of them. The Jew calculated exactly the time when the downfall of the princes was approaching and did his best to hasten it. I'm going to skip forward a little.
All right.
Every court had its court Jews, as this plague was called, who tortured the innocent victims until they were driven to despair, while at the same time this Jew provided the means which the princes squandered on their own pleasures. And that's what I mean. You know, Hitler's basically agreeing that the Jews are the panderer and the moneylender at the same time. Naturally, the Jew could now exploit the position to which he had attained and push himself forward even more rapidly than before. Finally, he became baptized and thus entitled to all the rights and privileges which belonged to the children of the nation on which he preyed. This was a high-class stroke of business for him, and he often availed himself of it to the great joy of the church, which was proud of having gained a new child in the faith, and also the joy of Israel, which was happy at seeing the trick pulled off successfully. Even as late as the time of Frederick the Great, nobody looked upon the Jews as other than a foreign people. And Goethe, rose up in revolt against the failure legally to prohibit marriage between Christians and Jews. Goethe was certainly no reactionary and no time server. What he said came from the voice of the blood and the voice of reason. And that's Mein Kampf, pages 176 and 177. Anybody
yes.
says Hitler was a Jew is an idiot. That's just,
well,
go read his book. There's no way a Jew could write any of that.
Maybe a little bit of comedy here, but you mind if I give you a little skit of my idea of how the Jews infiltrate into a noble bloodline?
Sure, go ahead, because they did it in Germany and they did it in England, and now at least half of the nobility of England is Jews.
Well, some noble heavily borrows from the Jew. The Jew says, "Certainly, I shall loan you this gold. Don't worry about it. Pay me when you get the money." And then several months later, "You don't have to repay the principal, but the interest is due now. You must pay me." And then several months later, this continues. Then it gets to the point where the nobleman is faced with bankruptcy and he's going to lose his estate. The Jew comes along. "Oy vey, I feel so sorry for you, my good friend, the prince. I tell you what, I have a daughter. I shall wipe out your debt if you marry her. And if you need money for the wedding, I know who can loan it to you."
Well, right. And that's exactly the way it worked in many cases, I'm sure.
And that, in a nutshell, is how the Jew gets his contaminated, polluted, satanic blood into the blood of a 4,000, 5,000-plus-year-old noble family.
And England's the perfect place for them to hide. Because England, in the English nobility, they take, when they gain a seat of nobility, they take a different name. Lord Winchester. Lord Colchester. That they don't, it's not Harry Steinberg. It's they get to hide behind those titles of nobility. And they don't care about their own name, so that's the perfect arrangement for them. I'd like somebody to publish a list of the names of the names of the English titles of nobility and the real names of the people that hold them.
I've actually found a list. There is a list, and if you want, I can give you a synopsis by 1937, how many Jews were there, or there were hereditary title holders of Jewish blood in England? 2 dukes, 7 earls, 7 marquises, 17 barons, 1 baroness, 1 dowager, 53 sirs. Someone says, if that was not enough, the following title holders have now married Jewish women, and their heirs, if any, will be Jewish by blood. 1 duke, 22 marquis, 3 earl, 3 viscounts, 10 barons, 22 sirs.
And that's just the ones that admit it.
And that's just as of 1937. We can imagine it's gotten worse with time.
I'm sure.
So the House of Lords might as well just be called the House of Canaan.
Absolutely. They've taken it over. They're the princes of this world. They were let out of the pit, and this is what they've done. Our kingdom has been handed over to the beast.
Well, I hope we get to the point where, as Martin Luther said, away with them, back into the pit.
Well, we will get to that point. But it when our people are going to wake up and how much they have to suffer first is left to be determined.
And hopefully it comes sooner rather than later, because I don't know if we can take much more of this.
Basically, the picture that Wiebe draws in his first chapter is a picture of 150 years from the French Revolution forward, roughly, of a Jew that is assimilating into the upper classes and middle classes of Europe.
Outwardly.
Yes, outwardly.
Since they were still financing revolt, they were encouraging the anarchism, the free love, the early socialist commune experiments, and I would say that the Jews absolutely were behind the revolutions of 1848.
Well, I was going to say they were absolutely the catalyst of the revolutions of 1848. Yes, there's no doubt. Now, Wiebe continues and says, some 40 years ago, a comparatively small number of Jews, headed by Dr. Theodor Herzl, founded what is known as the Zionist movement in the conscious recognition of the uselessness, nay, harmfulness, of the assimilation policy. and of the consequences that were bound to follow, the Zionist movement represented an effort to avoid those consequences. In other words, he's saying that a reaction against the Jews was bound to follow the assimilation period, and that the Zionist movement was an effort on the part of the Jews to avoid that. So basically, he's saying that it was Satan who was saving us from assimilating with Satan, is basically what that boils down to.
I would say he's incorrect in his conclusion as to what their motives for Zionism were. I think they just wanted a base of operations since they were tired of being at the mercy of the peasants who were prone to rise up from time to time, and they wanted somewhere they could call their own so they could organize, rest, lick their wounds, and recover.
Well, that's absolutely true, and Hitler considered Zionism a fraud.
Well, I have a quote that I selected to read about Hitler on Zionism. Can I read that?
Well, I hope it's the one where he says that they really want Israel just to be a criminal operation.
Well, mine was from page 41. Do you have one as well?
Yeah, I have one in here somewhere
that
I plan on quoting. Go ahead and read it.
To outward appearances, it seemed as if only one group of Jews championed this movement, Zionism, while the great majority disapproved of it or even repudiated it. But an investigation of the situation showed that those outward appearances were purposely misleading. These outward appearances emerged from a mist of theories which had been produced for reasons of expediency, if not for purposes of downright deception. For that part of Jewry which was styled liberal did not disown the Zionists as if they were not members of their race, but rather as brother Jews who publicly professed their faith in an unpractical way so as to create a danger for Jewry itself. Thus, there was no real rift in their internal solidarity. This fictitious conflict between the Zionists and the liberal Jews soon disgusted me, for it was false through and through and in direct contradiction to the moral dignity and immaculate character on which that race had always prided itself. That's 41 to 42.
Well, my quote is from page 184 of Mein Kampf.
All right.
The Jewish domination in the state seems now so fully assured that not only can he now afford to call himself a Jew once again, but he even acknowledges freely and openly what his ideas are on racial and political questions. This sounds just like America in the 1900s. A section of the Jews avows itself quite openly as an alien people. But even here, there is another falsehood. When the Zionists try to make the rest of the world believe that the new national consciousness of the Jews will be satisfied by the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, the Jews thereby adopt another means to dupe the simple-minded Gentile. They have not the slightest intention of building up a Jewish state in Palestine so as to live in it. What they are really aiming at is to establish a central organization for their international swindling and cheating. As a sovereign state, this cannot be controlled by any of the other states. Therefore, it can serve as a refuge for swindlers who have been found out, and at the same time, a high school for the training of other swindlers. And that's exactly what it's become.
That's all they've used it for.
That's exactly what they've used it for, and Adolf Hitler was exactly right.
It's a mafia safe house.
Exactly. It's a mafia safe house. It's a huge prostitution venture for where they kidnap young Eastern European women into prostitution and sell them as sex slaves. They actually have they've moved a great deal of our technology industry over there.
Yes, and I'd like to tie this back in with a quote again from you Gentiles. We Jews, we are the destroyers and will remain the destroyers. And this part, pay attention to. Nothing you can do will meet our demands and needs. We will forever destroy because we want a world of our own. He doesn't say we want a state of our own. He says we want a world of our own.
Right. They want a perverted world that they could do anything in, and there's no moral strictures, there's no racial barriers, there's no national barriers. That's Jew heaven.
Palestine will never be enough for them. They want to contaminate ultimately they're going to utterly destroy the entire world by destroying the blood of mankind, our people. That's their end goal.
Absolutely. That's their goal is to break down all barriers. The only way to break down all barriers is to bastardize everything. And that's the Jewish ideal. The Jewish ideal is the bastard. It will be seen that the British government recognized expressly the existence of a Jewish question and the necessity of its solution at a time when belief in the blessings of an assimilation of the Jewish race prevailed without contestation in Germany. In 1917, Zionism won a decisive victory with the publication of the Balfour Declaration by the British government, which promised unreserved British support of the endeavor to create a Jewish national home in Palestine. The fulfillment of this promise began shortly after the Great War. But after the lapse of 20 years, the failure of the effort is obvious. Well, we still see the failure of the effort, don't we? In the light of experience, Herzl's scheme has been proved impracticable. Herzl did not foresee the wave of anti-Semitism which is now sweeping over Europe, or at any rate, did not calculate its rapidity.
Oh, I think he foresaw it entirely. He was counting on it because it would serve as an impetus whereby several million Jews would flee to Palestine to provide the necessary manpower for their mafia safe haven, while the rest would be scattered throughout the world as they've always been.
Well, absolutely. It's run as a crime. It's run as a crime, a criminal entity.
Well, the way I look at it, people who understand classic Maoist guerrilla warfare, Mao said that you must be as a fish hiding in an ocean, meaning that if you're a Chinaman, you need a country with lots of Chinamen so you can hide among your co-ethnics. If you're an Iraqi, you have to be in a country with Iraqis so you can hide amongst your co-ethnics while you wage your insurgency. And the Jew is a mamzer mongrel cosmopolitan. He needs an entire world of mamzer mongrel cosmopolitans so he can wage his cultural insurgency against the white Western Christian civilization amongst his co-ethnics. He has to be able to hide amongst a population base similar to his own.
Well,
so that's why the Jews are never going to just pack up and all go to Israel, or shall we say occupied Palestine. They don't want to.
Wiebe goes on page 8 to discuss how the multitude of Arabs, in the face of 32 million Arabs, it would be practically impossible for the Jews to remain in Palestine. But I don't think Wiebe foresaw the lengths that America would go to keep the Jews in Palestine.
And in fact, I highlighted this quote here. Shall I go ahead and read the section?
Be my guest.
Up to now, the Zionist movement has only succeeded in settling some 400,000 Jews in Palestine. On the other hand, Palestine counts over 900,000 Arab inhabitants whose forefathers have lived in the country for more than 1,000 years. The Arabs contest, and rightly contest, the Jewish claim to regard Palestine as a Jewish national home. And behind the Palestinian Arabs are 32 million Arabs in the Near East and Egypt. Whatever agreement may be reached regarding a delimitation of the respective rights, it is safe to say that under existing circumstances, the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine of any dimension worth mentioning, or indeed of any viable Jewish state at all, is more than hypothetical. And my comment then is just that Jews have no compunction about starting war, even perpetual war. Their Talmud tells them they may take the lands of the Goyim, so why would they hesitate to basically manipulate other Goyims, those in, say, France, Britain, Germany, and the United States of America, into propping up and sending money and spilling their blood for the survival of their non-viable state of Israel?
Well, absolutely, and we didn't foresee that all of the technology that we would supply, we would be able to have to supply the Jews with, that would allow them to build the fortress Israel that they built there, and to maintain that land. It's not without great expense, but it's being done.
He probably wasn't aware of the extent and the totalness with which they dominated the United States, was he?
Right, and I don't think Hitler was even aware of that. And that's why he didn't foresee getting so badly beaten in the Second World War.
And when he goes on to talk about how the Jews might make it in Palestine, I like the part where he says, point 5 on page 12, the Jews are solely adapted to certain conditions of urban life and that they lack in general all capacity for agriculture or manual labor. And here again, my remark is simply that vampires cannot live alone. They require productive people to sponge off of. That's one of the other reasons that the Jews won't all go to Israel. If they were all in Israel, they wouldn't have the necessary numbers in our countries, obviously, since they wouldn't have any people in our countries. How would they dominate the political institutions in our countries and get our countries to basically steal the labor of productive citizens and send the results, the finished products, the money to Israel?
Absolutely. They only want enough Jews in Israel to make it look like they have it now, to put the pretense up that they're trying to make a nation there.
And it's by with our so-called government sending the fruits of our labor to Israel, we've effectively been enslaved for the benefit of the Jew, haven't we? Since they are stealing the fruits of our labor, they're basically stealing our labor. They might as well just have us on a plantation.
Absolutely. But that's, you know, that's what the whole money system is all about anyway. Our entire money system is about being enslaved to the Jew. Theodor Herzl's plan for enabling the Jews to escape the threatening peril of anti-Semitism has proved impracticable and has not succeeded at all in solving the Jewish problem. That's Wiebe on page 8. And
right.
Here Wiebe presents the fact that a clash between the Jews and the world is inevitable, where he says that, thus, what we may call the assimilation era has come to an end after about 150 years without any possibility for the Jews to escape in time the inevitable consequences of an unavoidable reaction. There can be no doubt whatever that the countercurrent of anti-Semitism is rapidly increasing in strength the world over. And we're going to discuss this in Eastern Europe, because Wiebe was right. It's just that it was all this, the American people were never informed of it, and it was destroyed. And we're going to find out why Eastern Europe was destroyed after World War II and handed over to the Soviets. And the key is here, okay? That even a cursory glance at the papers of many lands suffices to show that the responsible leaders of states in all corners of the globe are compelled in varying degrees to take account of this phenomenon. Foreign critics who maintain that anti-Semitism is limited to Germany may be reminded of the well-known words of the Zionist champion Dr. Chaim Weizmann, that the world is divided into two groups, namely those countries which desire to expel the Jews and those which do not desire to receive them.
That's always how it is. And my comment here was that when Jewish power begins to reach its zenith and the people become awakened to the reality of the Jewish plague, they naturally expel them.
Unless you're in America in the 1980s and 70s and 60s.
Yes, so I would have to agree with part of what Wiebe is saying, but clearly the assimilation era really isn't over. It's gotten a great lift here in the United States, hasn't it? Where people marry Jews.
Right, it has gotten a great lift, and he couldn't foresee this. He couldn't foresee this.
He's right about the backlash.
Absolutely, and it's the natural result of having the two competing groups, and one group feeding off the other. Eventually, the host gets angry with the parasite because the parasite eats too much. I mean, it's part of the natural result of having a parasite run around in your country unleashed.
Well, if you're
like to quote the what Wiebe says about the first group. And he divides the world's countries into two groups. And they're the two groups that Chaim Weizmann, the Jew, had classified. And Wiebe says that the first of these groups includes not only Germany, but also Italy. And this all happened in the run-up to World War II. In the later country, comprehensive legislative measures have been directed alike to excluding Italian Jews from public life and to getting rid of foreign Jews. Mention may also be made of Poland with a Jewish population of over 3 million or over 10% of the entire population. Not only have various specified professions already been entirely closed to the Jews in Poland, but it has been officially stated in Warsaw that the problem of the Polish Jews can only be solved by emigration, in other words, by the Jews leaving. In Hungary, a bill originally brought in by the Dohnányi cabinet has been reintroduced by the Imreti cabinet, they were two prime ministers, aims at restricting Jewish participation in economic and cultural life. In Romania, which has some 1.5 million Jews, the anti-Semitic movement has by no means come to an end with the collapse of the Goga ministry, as is shown by the extensive measures since adopted and by aiming at the deprivation of their recently acquired Romanian nationality of all Jews who have immigrated into Romania since the Great War. So what Romania did was it stripped all Jews of citizenship, basically, that entered in since World War I. There can be no doubt that anti-Semitism is constantly progressing in Romania and will sooner or later become the dominating factor in that country. Now, I have to propose that the reason why the Rothschild and the American and English Jews wanted to hand Eastern Europe over to the Soviets was because what we're seeing from Wiebe here was a big backlash in Eastern Europe against Jewry.
And it required Soviet military power to stifle it.
Exactly, and the American public was never informed of this backlash against Jewry. I've never heard of it until I read Wiebe. And I'm willing to bet that the American public was absolutely ignorant, kept in the dark by the Jewish media.
Well, it stands to reason, since the Jewish media kept them in the dark as to the Jewish nature of communism. So why wouldn't they keep them in the dark?
So that I believe that's what happened. The Jews got mad at the Eastern European nations because there was a huge backlash against the Jews in all of them. Poland, Hungary, Romania.
Well, one thing I've pointed out in an argument earlier with my father, talking about who's responsible for World War II, I said that if Germany is responsible for World War II by invading Poland, why then did Britain and France not extend the declaration of war to the Soviet Union? Because Germany did not invade Poland alone.
Right. It was all a lie. It was all a lie. It was a Jewish conspiracy against Christendom. That's what World War II was all about. The American public and the English public were kept blinded as to the real reasons for the war, and the banking class and the upper classes had basically roped us into killing our brethren. That's what happened in World War II.
I have a little comparison scenario here for the countries that wish to expel Jews and those that don't, and about those that are the mounting backlash. And I say that if you're a dog which has thus far spent his entire life rife with fleas, and you finally get to experience life free of fleas, does anybody need to do anything to communicate to you that you are better off?
Right. Absolutely.
I mean,
what about the countries that the other set of countries that didn't want to receive, the second group of countries, those who did not want to receive the Jews, comprises the states into which Jewish immigrants have poured as a result of the growing anti-Semitic peril. They are mostly overseas countries. First and foremost, among them being South American republics and the Union of South Africa. So Wiebe is telling us that Jews were pouring into the Union of South Africa in the 30s. And what were the fruits of that? What happened to South Africa in the 70s and 80s?
Well, the Jews founded a very strong and robust communist party, which had gained so much ground by the 40s and 50s that South Africa basically became under siege, pretty much. And they agitated all the blacks, the generally peaceful Kaffirs who were content to work for the white man and benefit from the white man's civilization. Suddenly, it seems almost overnight, they'd gone from basically being docile workers to revolutionaries that wanted to burn down the farm instead of work on the farm.
Right. And my question was rhetorical. The Jews founded the ANCP, or that African National Communist Party, or and the other African communist parties. The Jews founded all of them. They enlisted all the blacks, and they used them as a wedge against the whites. And that's the bottom line. Judaism, just like Jews founded the NAACP here, they did the same thing in Africa. Wherever you find a Jew, a black, and a white man in the same room, the white man's going to be outvoted 2-1 every time. It's just the way it works. That's the way the Jews are.
The South African Communist Party was founded in 1921. Just a tidbit there.
Okay.
And it wasn't declared illegal until 1950. And I've actually seen pictures.
Yeah, well, that's when the Dutch probably got sick of hearing their whining.
In the 30s, they had the slogan, "Workers of the world, unite and fight for a white South Africa." But very few whites joined, so they started making appeals to all the blacks. And they shifted focus from class to race.
Well, that's what they do. They agitate.
Oh, and one of the leading members of the ANC was Joe Slovo. And no, that was not his name. His birth name was Yoshal Mashal Slovo.
There you
have
it.
And he hailed from Lithuania.
There you have it. Founding member of the ANC is a Jew. I mean,
yes.
You don't. I didn't have to read it. I just knew it. I mean, I'm sorry. That sounds arrogant, but it's just the truth.
And his family immigrated to South Africa in 1934. It looks like, yes, 1934. They left Lithuania, and he joined the Communist Party when he wasn't even 20 years old, and he joined the South African Communist Party.
And I'm sure that's exactly what Wiebe was talking about here. That's exactly what I just quoted from Wiebe. That's the direct result of it. The Jews leave and find who will take them, and as soon as they get to a new host, they start trouble. They start agitating for their social justice and the rest of their perversions.
Absolutely.
Mein Kampf, page 184. He will stop at nothing. His utterly low-down conduct is so appalling that one really cannot be surprised if in the imagination of our people, the Jew is pictured as the incarnation of Satan and the symbol of evil. Now, Adolf Hitler, he didn't know how close he was with that one. I'm sorry. He didn't know how well he was portraying the Jews, I think.
This ties right in with a Wiebe quote I wanted to read from page 15. Germany's attitude towards the Jewish question can be rightly understood only if we consider it from the standpoint of a philosophy of history based on the conception of the race as fundamental factor of social evolution, i.e. of the philosophy which from the outset has inspired the National Socialist effort to reconstruct and reorganize the entire life of the German nation. Pay close attention to this part here. According to this philosophy, the differentiation and variety of the heterogeneous human races, as well as of the peoples who descend from them, constitute an essential element of the divine creative purpose. Is not this the fundamental belief and teaching of Hitler, National Socialism, Scripture, and our movement?
Absolutely. And he could have got that right from Hitler. You're moving me up about 6 pages in my notes, by the way.
Okay. Well, you must have numbered your pages differently, because my page 15 sounds like your page 12.
Are you working from a file that I sent you? I've repaginated it.
Okay, because I'm working from the original scan of the book, whereby 2 pages appear on one page. Page 14 is on the left side, and page 15 is on the right side.
Okay. I don't know where you are, but that's okay.
Okay.
We've been talking about the fact that there is a Jewish problem in not only in Germany, but in all of Europe. And this is recognized in all of Eastern Europe. And I think next week we should concentrate on why there was a Jewish problem. And Wiebe gets into that in great depth. and we should expound on that, on what the actual nature of the Jewish problem is. Aside from the obvious anti-Christian sentiments of the Jews.
Yes, but you mean like the specific indictment statistics regarding their involvement in dope peddling, prostitution, pornography, child molestation, robberies, organized crime, communist agitation, and the list just goes on and on, and we could be here until 2 a.m.
And right, not only the criminal enterprises they had in Germany and everything they did with that, but also the destruction of European culture through Jewish arts and entertainment.
Their art is absolutely vulgar, vile, and disgusting. As Gerald says, products of a Jewish mind.
Yes. Well, look at their pictures and those pictures you were just looking at, and that's, you know, they form their art in their own image.
Yes, and their image is disgusting. When I look at those people, I don't even, they're just evil in physical form. I told my dad that to me, the Jew is a demon in human form.
Well, that's what they are. Exactly what they are. There's no doubt. That's
they
why
simply,
Christ told them they were of their father, the devil.
They simply bear the countenance and the outward physical appearance of a human. But as I've said, just because a German shepherd can mate with a pit bull and have viable offspring that is not infertile doesn't mean that a German shepherd is identical to a pit bull in body, mind, and spirit, does it?
Not at all.
Seems that
it's definitely not. I mean, it's a bastard. A bastard is always going to be. That's why we have that word. That's why we use the word bastard as a curse, because that's what it is.
Yet today we've been led to believe that it just means that your mother and father didn't have some slip of paper signed by the justice of the peace at the time you were conceived and born. How ludicrous is that notion?
Absolutely.
And I asked my dad, I said, did the ancient Israelites go to the justice of the peace and get a little slip of paper?
No, marriage happens in a bed, period. Marriage, in the eyes of God, happens in a bed. It doesn't happen at an altar with a government approval.
And I think Hitler understood this too, didn't he, to some extent? When he talks about Jews ruining white women by mating with them, on page 184, he says, the black-haired Jewish youth lies in wait for hours on end, satanically glaring at and spying on the unsuspicious girl whom he plans to seduce, adulterating her blood and removing her from the bosom of her own people. The Jew uses every possible means to undermine the racial foundations of a subjugated people. In his systematic efforts to ruin girls and women, he strives to break down the last barriers of discrimination between him and other peoples. So it seems to me that Hitler understands to some extent that miscegenation is the blasphemy of the spirit. I don't know if he would bring that term, since he may not understand that term, but he understands the end result is the same.
Absolutely. He understood the Genesis 3 account was all about race mixing. That there is no doubt that he understood that. He understood the Bible. I'm going to quote Hitler on original sin.
Okay.
For the original sin committed in paradise has always followed the expulsion of the guilty parties. All right, I have to read a little before that because I wasn't prepared for this. Aryan tribes, often almost ridiculously small in number, subjugated foreign peoples and stimulated by the conditions of life which their new country offered them. Now, I'm going to say this is true after the Scythians dispersed to the east. Stimulated by the conditions of life which their new country offered them, fertility, the nature of the climate, etc., and profiting also by the abundance of manual labor furnished them by the inferior race, they developed intellectual and organizing faculties which had hitherto been dormant in these conquering tribes. Within the course of a few thousand years or even centuries, they gave life to cultures whose primitive traits completely corresponded to the character of their founders. Though modified by adaptation to the peculiarities of the soil and the characteristics of the subjugated people. But finally, the conquering race offended against the principles which they had first observed, namely the maintenance of their racial stock unmixed, and they began to intermingle with the subjugated people. Thus they put an end to their own separate existence, for the original sin committed in paradise has always been followed by the expulsion of the guilty parties. In other words, even though he doesn't have this history of the Aryan tribes subjugating non-Aryan people and mixing with them is a limited history, and it's true in circumstances, he understood fully that the Genesis 3 event was all about race mixing.
And isn't
that's
that
the metaphor that he's drawing.
Isn't this the same? It's the story of the fall of essentially every nation our people have founded that has morphed from a republic or some sort of representative government into an empire that included people of other races.
Absolutely. And I'm going to quote again, that such a mentality may be possible cannot be denied in a world where hundreds and thousands accept the principle of celibacy from their own choice. He's talking about the church, and he's blasting the church for their celibacy policy.
Yes.
Without being obliged or pledged to do so by anything except an ecclesiastical precept, why should it not be possible to induce people to make this sacrifice if instead of such a precept, they were simply told that they ought to put an end to the truly original sin of racial corruption, which is steadily being passed from one generation to another, and further, they ought to be brought to realize that it is their bounden duty to give to the Almighty Creator beings such as He Himself made to His own image.
Amen.
He goes on to say, for in a world which would be composed of mongrels and negroids, all ideals of human beauty and nobility, and all hopes of an idealized future for our humanity would be lost forever. Adolf Hitler's racism is definitely grounded in Scripture.
Absolutely. And
it's founded on the Bible.
He understood we were put here to take the planet back from the Jew.
Well, and he makes allusions to that we'll probably read before this series is over with, that the Genesis 1 man is the... He knew that the man of Genesis was the Aryan man. He knew that the Jew was an interloper. He knew that the Jew was satanic. He knew that the Jew wasn't really, you know, he called them God's so-called chosen. He never called them God's chosen. He knew that that race mixing was the original sin. He knew he would be a dual seed line Christian identity pastor today.
Despite what the Odinists, the heathens, and all the other weirdos claim.
Absolutely. You know, Odinism and I've read all the Eddas. I've read the Nibelungen Lied. I've read a great deal of the Germanic literature, the Voluspa.
There's basically no racialism in it, is there?
There's no racialism in it. There's no defense of race. There's no defense against the Jew. The Jews loved pagan Europe. The Jews only had a hard time with Europe once it became Christianized. The Jews were doing just dandy in pagan Rome. They were the principal moneylenders of pagan Rome. Christianity put a stop to that. Christianity defended the Aryan man from the Jew. Paganism never defended the Aryan man from the Jew. Never.
Absolutely. Well, I've sort of made an observation about most of the adherents of National Socialism, or the so-called adherents, they are like most Marxists. Most Marxists seem to be 15 to 20-year-olds. They've never actually read Marx because... like him or dislike him, and I would say I obviously dislike him and I feel he's incorrect, but his work is still pretty deep and you have to analyze it, just like Hitler is deep and you have to analyze it. Most Marxists have not read Marx. Most modern Nazis have not read Hitler.
Absolutely not. Absolutely. Most kids don't read. That's first. I mean, very few of our youth actually read. They get their ideas from television and movies, and they run with it.
Yes. So they think that all you have to do to be a Marxist is make a clenched fist, raise it in the air, and wear a Che Guevara T-shirt.
Right, and it's cool, but they really have a clue what they're doing. They have no idea what they're signing on to.
And a lot of people think that Nazism is simply Sieg Heiling and getting drunk and getting in the fights.
Right, and most of the pagans I knew, most of the pagan men, I'm gonna be honest, I knew a lot of them in my life, and they were all the barrier to even racially aware Christianity was morality. They couldn't deal with the precepts of morality. They couldn't deal with the idea that they couldn't just go sleeping with any old whore that wanted to on any particular night. They liked the party. They liked diving in between two women, and half the women out there today are engaging in lesbian activity. And the pagan men just love that. They eat that up.
I've noticed that from my approximately seven years on Stormfront prior to being banned, that the pagans have no concept of Christian morality. They despise our morality, and they mock us as American Taliban.
That's because their minds have been exercised by the Jew. Everything that they think they know comes from Jewish media and entertainment sources, period. Because they haven't really read Mein Kampf. They would hate Hitler. They would hate Hitler because he was a moral Christian man.
And it's occurred to me that if Hitler were here, he would probably have most of them conscripted in the forced labor battalions because he would consider them social miscreants, and rightly so.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. All those holes in their heads and their piercings and everywhere else they have them, I hate to think of half the places. Yeah, they're absolutely miscreants.
He would tell them to, you know, put down the beer, pick up a shovel, and get to work on some road project.
Right, and he's their hero, and he wouldn't have a damn thing to do with any of them.
Just like most of these misguided Marxist children living in their parents' basement that love Stalin so much, Stalin would probably have them all shot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But how is this? This is really no different from Christianity, though. Most people that profess a belief in Jesus, they've never read his book.
Right. And it's no different from Christianity.
So
it
seems that all
perceptions,
these...
People have a perception of Christ. They form God in their image. And then when they do open the Bible, they open it to prove that their idea of the world is the right idea, and they'll find a couple of verses to support what they want to prove, and they take them out of context and throw them out there, and they're self-justified. That's most Christians.
Well, they're just looking to validate their own existence, aren't they?
Exactly, in the way they form themselves.
They're looking for somebody to stamp their approval upon their lifestyle, which is typically disgusting and contrary to Scripture, so they have to disregard and ignore probably 98% of Scripture and then misinterpret and poorly translate the remaining 2%.
And that's what the Nazis do. That's what these National Socialist kids do with Hitler, and that's what they do with the Edas, and that's what the Wiccans do with whatever they think they believe. It's most people are just, they make their minds up with surface knowledge, and they join a team, signing on to religion or a political party. It's the same mentality as having a favorite baseball team, that team has to win and be right all the time, no matter what. And that's why they join the Baptists, and that's why they join the National Socialists, and that's why they join Stormfront or whatever. Any movement they join, it's like signing onto a team. It's us against you, and it's a very animalistic instinct.
And if they actually read Hitler and knew what he wrote, they probably wouldn't be following him for too long because he's not approving of their lifestyle.
It's like prison. In prison, I watched the Detroit niggers beat the hell out of the Cleveland niggers and vice versa, and the only reason why they were beating the hell out of each other was because one group was from Detroit and the other group was from Cleveland.
But they're all niggers.
Right, but I mean, it was, yeah, they're, what I'm saying is that they're extremely tribal. And most white people that have rejected our traditional classical culture and have accepted the Jew culture of television and movies and everything presented in the television and movies have the same mentality. They sign on to something because it's cool, because it's the thing to do, because it's what they feel like. It makes them feel good, and then they support it like fanatics, and they have no idea what it's really about.
So they're basically a fanatic about a misinterpretation, or they're a fanatic about a mistake.
Right. They're fanatics about being Baptists, and they're fanatics about being Giants fans.
They're fanatical in their erroneous adherence to some misguided doctrine or some muddled faith.
Absolutely. It's the pattern repeats itself again and again, and it repeats itself because people don't read, and they get their education from the Jewish media. And the Jew's safe in it all, and the Jew loves it. The Jews eat this up. They love the fact that so many people are locked into being evangelicals, locked into being Baptists. They love Christian Zionists. They love white pagans. They hate Christian identists.
Now, why is that?
They hate Christian identists.
Well, we're the only ones that are presenting a threat to them. We are
Absolutely.
A viable threat.
They hate people that read books. They hate people that study, and they hate people that know what they're talking about. They hate informed people.
They must really hate us, then.
I've seen it in my personal experience over and over again.
I'm on my 7th book in the last 4 weeks. But Mein Kampf was pretty deep and involved, so it's taken me a while to get through it.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. If Mein Kampf took me a couple of months to read, because I would only read 5-6 pages at a time. It was so heavy. And I mean, I'd spend hours thinking about what I read.
It's taken me about 3 hours for every 20 pages, where normally if I just picked up a random book, I'd be through 150 pages in 3 hours.
Right.
Mein Kampf,
it's a very heavy read, and it needs to be well thought out. You can't rush through it. I mean, if you rush through it, you're just cheating yourself. And most of the good books I've read in my life are like that.
And it seems that how many Americans do you think have actually read Mein Kampf or even attempted to read it?
I'm sure probably numbers in a couple of thousand, and that's about it. And most of them have read the Mannheim translation. I mean, a lot of people might have it on their shelves, but they haven't read it.
They're really not entitled to form an opinion of Hitler, then, are they?
No, none of the National Socialists are entitled to form an opinion, period, until they've read the Murphy translation of Mein Kampf and understand it.
And they're not going to go do that, though.
Hell no. It takes way too much time away from their porn time.
Well, I figure maybe at some point we should have an open invitation to the National Socialist pagans, not on this series. We don't want to disrupt this series, but we can have some separate show schedule where they're welcome to make a case for Hitler not being a Christian. They can call in, and whatever case they come up with, they can present, and then we can overwhelm them with the truthful, you know, the truthful case.
Well, I put my Mein Kampf website up for that very purpose.
Have you had any bites yet? Anyone taken the bait?
No, all I have right now is I have some Jew harassing me with registering 50, 60 usernames at a time and trying to get in so he could spam my site. And,
typical.
And I have to put a CAPTCHA up on registration. I'll probably do that tomorrow night.
So basically you have a Jew who's being a Jew.
Well, yeah, it's probably a Jew or some other idiot.
All right, then. So you want to just pick up where we left off with Weeby next week, and we just open this up for an informal chat, or should this be it, and I'll talk to you next week?
Well, I'll give you until 11 o'clock if you want to open up for an informal chat. I have a lot of things to do tomorrow. I don't want to stay too late. And next week we should probably – I would like to pick it up to where Weeby describes why the Jews are a problem. Because tonight we've elucidated that there's a problem, but we really haven't elucidated why. And that would be around the part two, Jews in German economic life, and from there forward, maybe. Jews in corruption is part three.
So I'd say we've covered the what, the when, and the who. Now we're going to get into the why.
Right, the why and the how. That'll do it.
All right. So I'm going to stop the recording, and we'll open this up for anybody who wants to call in.
Great. Praise Yahweh.